Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Did God really command genocide in the Old Testament, as we often hear skeptics say? And if he did, how can we reconcile this with the God of love? And if he did, what would you say to somebody who claimed that God told him to kill people? And if God really did command the killings of the innocents in the Old Testament, why did he ask Israel to do it? I mean, he could have killed them directly himself, like he did with Sennacherib's army. And how do the Old Testament commands to kill differ from what ISIS is doing? And by the way, aren't Christians supposed to turn the other cheek? Aren't we supposed to be nonviolent? These are just some of the issues that are brought up in a book called Did God Really Command Genocide? The subtitle is Coming to Terms with the Justice of God, written by my friend Paul Copan and Matthew Flanagan. And we have Dr. Copan on the program with us. Paul's been on the show before. His famous book, Is God a Moral Monster?, preceded this one called Did God Really Command Genocide? So, Paul, great having you on again.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you again.
Now, Paul, this book, the new book called Is or Did God Really Command Genocide, you cover a lot of ground in this book, and you provide very nuanced discussions of some very critical issues that are often misunderstood, and they're frankly caricatured by critics. You know, critics set up these simplified straw men arguments to knock them down. They don't seem to take the time or make the effort to understand the meaning and historical context of the Old Testament like you and Matthew have in this book. So they wind up criticizing the Old Testament for something it's not saying. And you cover such a wide variety of topics in this book. It's not just solely about genocide, but you get into just violence in general, and has religion been violent? I mean, it's a great book. I want to encourage our listeners to get it. Again, it's called Did God Really Command Genocide? So our discussion today is just going to skim the surface of these issues. But Paul, let me start by stating something that I think many people miss. And that is, it seems to me that alleged moral problems in the Bible do provide a challenge for Christians like you and me and our listeners. But let me ask you this. Why don't the atheists have any ground to complain about what they see as moral problems in the Bible or anywhere else for that matter?
Well, one of the fundamental things that we have to ask when we do hear these sorts of criticisms about the, quote, God of the Old Testament, and we should take these challenges seriously. In fact, Christians are troubled by them. We see books being written that address these challenges, books like, you know, God Behaving Badly, or The Violence of Scripture, or those sorts of titles. And we shouldn't just gloss over these challenges, but we can, in many ways, thank the critics for prompting us to look more closely at the scriptures and to give a more articulate defense in a culture that no longer takes biblical authority for granted. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. But secondly, when the critics who are like the new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and so forth, they launch into this criticism of the God of the Old Testament as being evil, being a moral monster, but yet in their writings, they have no room, no metaphysical room for accounting for the emergence of evil. How could evil exist in a world of selfish genes and electrons? In fact, right. Richard Dawkins himself says that there is no good or evil in such a world, nothing but blind, fatalist indifference. We are just basically dancing to the music of our DNA. So how then can you launch and criticize the, quote, religious evils when you yourself don't have any room within your worldview to account for it? So there is presupposes that things are not the way they ought to be. And so if there is a way things ought to be, this presupposes a kind of design plan. And naturalism has no room for a design plan. Things just are. There is no ought to be given naturalism.
Yes, that's very well said, Paul. And I just want our listeners to realize that while these challenges from the Old Testament do present just that, a challenge to Christians, atheists have no moral standard by which to judge anything as wrong, much less what they find in the Old Testament. So they, in effect, have to steal this standard from God in order to argue against him. But it is a fair question for an atheist to say, look, regardless of my worldview, your worldview, Paul, says that you believe in a loving God. How does that square with what the Old Testament says? Now, you began addressing this issue back in Is God a Moral Monster, this issue of so-called genocide. And you look at some of the texts in the Old Testament, and they seem to say, wipe everybody out. Everybody needs to be killed. The women and children need to go as well. How do you respond? Is that really what the text is asking the Israelites to do?
Kind of interesting when you read these texts related to the Canaanites, to the Midianites in Numbers 31, in when it comes to the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15, you have this sweeping language of utter destruction, of leaving alive nothing that breathes, and so on. And then you see that these things have been done. Joshua talks about how the land had rest and there were no survivors, and how Saul utterly destroyed the Amalekites. How the Midianites, every male was killed, etc. Well, then you keep reading and you find out that, oh, no, actually there are lots of Canaanites left in Judges 1 and 2. You keep on reading this refrain, they could not drive them out, they could not drive them out. These Canaanites are still entrenched. In fact, they are there to this day. You have the same thing with the Midianites, that here you see in Judges 6, 5 that they're too numerous to count, these Midianites who are ganging up against the Israelites. You see the Amalekites, who, by the way, did raid the Israelites in chapter 14. And when Saul says, when even the narrator says they've been utterly destroyed, you see in chapter 27, in chapter 31, you see mention of, or chapter 30, you see mention of Lot. David is fighting these Amalekites again. There's an army that he's fighting against. 400 escaped. So if they've been utterly destroyed, then why do these people keep on popping up all over? Well, if you understand that in the ancient Near East, they had a kind of trash talk where you say, we utterly destroyed them, we left alive nothing breathes, we turned them to ash. This was part of the trash talk of the ancient Near East. It was hyperbole, there was exaggeration. And so we shouldn't be surprised that if you have that kind of trash talk, like we do when we're saying, oh, we totally annihilated the other team, we don't take that with literal seriousness. We understand that there is hyperbole here. In the same way, we see that in ancient Near Eastern texts, an army could barely eke out a victory against another army, and use and write in their inscriptions with bragging rights. We totally destroyed them. They are no longer they no longer exist, etc. So that's the sort of backdrop that we need to understand as we look at this. And if you understand that, then there is no contradiction between this trash talk, this hyperbole, and the existence of an abundance of survivors.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Copan. His new book, along with Matthew Flanagan, is called Did God Really Command Genocide? Coming to Terms with the Justice of God. It covers a lot of ground. It's a book you need to get because not only is it well written, but there's summaries at the end of each chapter, and it will help you kind of get the main points of what's being said there. And when we come back from the break, I want to ask Dr. Copan if his theory that most of this is hyperbole stands. What does that do for biblical inerrancy? And why can't we just take the text at face value? And does that mean that God is using hyperbole? And how do we really decipher this? So when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about that. We'll also talk about how does this square with the God of love? And what would you say to someone who claimed God told him to kill people? And how does this compare to ISIS? We'll get into all that a little bit later. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. Back in 2 minutes. Welcome back to Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. If you're low on the FM dial looking for National Public Radio, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. I can guarantee you, you're not going to hear this discussion on NPR. And we're talking to my friend Dr. Paul Copan, author of several books, including Did God Really Command Genocide? Coming to Terms with the Justice of God, co-authored by Matthew Flanagan. I think Matthew's from New Zealand, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Paul?
Correct, yep.
Yeah, he's from down under. You guys coordinated across great distances because you're down at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida as a professor, and he's down under. It's amazing what we can do and with today's technology. In any event, I want to pick up the conversation where you left it off. You were talking about how you believe that the so-called extermination commands in the Old Testament were ancient hyperbole, and you said that this was common in ancient Near East writings, not just the Old Testament, but other ancient Near East writings. But what does that do for our concept of inerrancy? I mean, is God using hyperbole to try and communicate something? Why wouldn't he use more precise language if this is truly is the word of God to get us what he wants us to understand?
Well, this question that a lot of people ask rests on the misunderstanding that the only appropriate vehicle to communicate truth has to be through, say, historical narrative or straightforward propositions, and that God could not communicate truth through metaphor, through hyperbole, through what? Parable? What? Prophetic language and poetry and so forth. And we see a lot of different genres in Scripture, and not all of them are straightforward historical narrative. They are very much in the, we need to see it as a wide array of different genres that require different principles of interpretation to make sense of them. A genre is kind of like, it's like a contract between the author and his audience, that there are certain rules that they have by which they'll operate, that if you understand those rules, then you will appreciate and understand what the author is trying to express. But if you have this one-size-fits-all grid by which you interpret all types of literature, then you will actually distort what the author is trying to communicate. So we see in the language of Scripture, we see the trees of the field, will clap their hands. We see language of Jesus even, using the metaphor, tell Herod that fox, that we see Jesus saying, I am the door, I am the bread of life, and so forth. Should we take those literally? Of course not. Well, does that compromise the truth of Scripture? No, certainly not. God can use metaphor. He uses the various styles and types of writing within human cultures to communicate his truth. And so this means that we have to do our homework. But we also need to remember that, yes, it does say we left alive nothing that breathed, there were no survivors. But you also need to pay attention to the other side of the ledger, which says, they could not drive them out. They could not drive them out. They are here to this day. So we need to not just try to justify one side of the ledger and say, look at how clear the Scriptures are. The Scriptures are also with equal clarity saying that there are plenty of survivors, that this is not a sudden blitzkrieg that just wipes out the Canaanites. This is something that is very gradual, something that takes place over a much longer period of time. So it requires attention to not just select texts, but the broad range of texts within a particular genre that remind us of those sorts of tensions.
Now, what was the purpose of driving them out of the land? These people, the Canaanites, what kind of people were they, and why did God want them out of the land?
Well, of course, God had told the patriarchs, and Abraham in particular, that the Israelites would be enslaved in bondage for 430 years, that he would wait for the sin of the Amorites to be filled up, he says in Genesis 15:16. So you have, again, well over, 430 years, the time of Abraham. So basically they were in Egypt for 430 years. And so it's a long period of time to wait before the Canaanites get to the rock bottom level, morally speaking. So you have them engaging in practices that would be considered criminal in any civilized society. You've got bestiality. You've got ritual prostitution. You've got incest. You've got infant sacrifice. Those are the sorts of things that they're doing. It's not as though they just happen to like tattoos and we don't, or they don't circumcise their boys on the eighth day and we do. It's something much more drastic than that. And so when you understand the kind of people that they are, and also the patience that God shows over these hundreds of years and in waiting, and we see that God is very much willing for people to respond. In fact, you also have this fact that the Canaanites know very well that God delivered the Israelites from Egypt, that he performed signs and wonders in Egypt, and they could detect the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night over the camp of the Israelites. So you have very public signs, not just private revelations, but public signs that give the Canaanites fair warning that there is something very unique and significant about the God of the Israelites, and they ought to pay attention.
Well, you've documented this quite well. And again, the book is called Did God Really Command Genocide? Coming to Terms with the Justice of God. The authors are Paul Copan, my guest today, and Matthew Flanagan. And Paul, you really cover a large number of topics here in this book. I mean, you go, the first part deals with the texts themselves, the so-called genocide text. Then you talk about genocide massacres, and you talk about divine command theory in here, whether these commands are arbitrary commands. You talk even about the Euthyphro dilemma in here. You talk about, can one rationally believe that God commands that we kill innocent human beings? Let me just stop at that one for just a minute. It does God. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that the commands in the text, I know you don't agree with this, but the commands in the text were literal. Wipe out everybody. Does God have the authority to kill innocent human beings?
Well, sure he does. And by the way, before I even go further, let me say that Matthew Flanagan has done he has contributed a significant amount to this book. And so I want to give a shout out to him for the a lot of excellent, sophisticated, nuanced work that he's done on, say, divine command theory and so forth. There are nuances to unpack here. But God is the one who is the author of life. We see that God takes life at the flood. We see Sodom and Gomorrah, and of course the question is, are there even 10 righteous in the city? And there aren't, shockingly, in the city of Sodom. So the city is incinerated. But God, being the author of life, has authority over it. And so God does no one wrong since he takes life. He is the giver and the taker of life. And if life is a gift, how can we say that God has no authority to take life? Now, the question is, what about innocent human lives? And what if innocent lives are taken in the, in the Canaanite raids and so forth? What about that? Well, there is an assumption in the criticism that it is always wrong to take innocent human life, that this is an absolute command. Now, I would say that this is a general command, but it doesn't rise to the level of absolute. Let me distinguish briefly three types of duties or prohibitions. The first is an absolute duty to love God, or the absolute prohibition not to engage in idolatry. Those are unwavering. Those are absolute. There is no variation. There may be, however, when it comes to the general prohibition, that there are prima facie or duties, that there are general duties on the surface. It's like don't deceive, don't take innocent human life. But there may be overriding considerations. There may be cases of supreme emergency, like when Nazis are looking to take Jews from everybody's basement, that it would be morally permissible, and we see scripture even illustrating this, morally permissible to deceive in order to preserve innocent human life. In fact, God himself engages in deception when he sets an ambush against Israel's enemies. So we can come up with examples where innocent life may be justifiably taken in certain circumstances. So you think of an ectopic pregnancy, where you have a woman who has an embryo implanted in the fertilized egg implanted in the fallopian tube, rather than in the uterus, and both the mother and die. And so, at least to save one life, it would be morally permissible to, and though tragically, to take that unborn life than to see both of those lives lost. Or if a plane is hijacked and a president issues the order to shoot the plane out of the sky so that further massive damage won't be done, it may involve the killing of innocent women and children. As tragic as it is, it would still be morally permissible. Well, if we see in this situation, God, an all-wise, all-good, all-knowing God, if he issues the command, then it is not as though there is, for one thing, some intrinsic evil being commanded. It is something that is a difficult command, but knowing that God is wise and that he would have a morally justifiable reason for commanding it, then we could put this in its proper perspective. And we also need to remember, too, that this is a unique historical situation. It's not as though God says, yeah, anybody can do this at any time. No, this is specifically directed at the Canaanites. This is something that is specifically directed to the possession of the land that God had promised the Israelites, and they could not take it until the proper time, hundreds of years later, when the Canaanites had reached a moral rock bottom. So there are a lot of factors here, and we need to encourage people who are Christians, who are talking with these critics of theirs, to be a bit more patient and understanding as they engage in these sorts of topics. It does take a while. It does take some unpacking. But if people are readily dismissing it and not willing to listen to the nuance, they are really being unfair to what the biblical text is trying to do.
Yeah, I think we should expect an infinite God would have a nuanced revelation, and it is a nuanced revelation. And I see too many people just dismissing it, Paul, without even investigating it. I think they think that since we don't have the right generally to take life, innocent life, that God shouldn't have it either. But yet he's the giver of life, as you mentioned, so he can take life. And by the way, the same people who say they're, that God is immoral for killing innocent human beings are the same people who are pro-abortion. You know, when God plays God, he's immoral, but when we play God, somehow that's a moral right. So I think people are very inconsistent on this topic, and we're going to talk more to Dr. Paul Copan. His book is called Did God Really Command Genocide? Coming to Terms with the Justice of God. It covers a lot of ground, and it's very nuanced, very well thought out, great summaries at the end of each chapter. You need to see this book. You need to get it. I download it on Kindle in a minute. It's great, great reading. So check it out. I'm Frank Turk. Back more with Dr. Copan right after this. Did God really command genocide? That's the topic we're talking about today with my guest, Dr. Paul Copan, author of a book by the same name. And we're dealing with issues that have perplexed people for quite a while, and of course these are issues that non-believers jump on all the time, so you should be informed on the matter. And prior to our break, and if you're just tuning in, you got to listen to the first half of the show. We can't recover everything we just did, but Dr. Copan was talking about the fact that God does have the moral authority to take innocent human beings to remove his hand from them. And in fact, ladies and gentlemen, whenever somebody dies, if God exists, and he does, and he's the author and taker of life, whenever somebody dies, God has removed his hand from them, at least in this life. Now, technically, people don't really die. They just change location. They go from this life to the next life, if Christianity is indeed true. And God can take somebody from this life to the next life at any point he wants to, whether they're 82 years old or 2 years old, that's up to him. We don't have that same right, but we're not the author and resurrector of life. God is. God can do that. So these are the issues we're discussing today. And Paul, I think you may have mentioned this in the book, Did God Really Command Genocide? That fourth plane heading probably toward the Capitol during 9/11, we were about to shoot it down, weren't we?
We were. The command was issued, but too late.
Right. That was to save more innocents. We decided that it would be better to take down a plane that did have innocent people on it because we live in a fallen world and sometimes these moral commands conflict. But let me ask you this question, Paul. This is an interesting question. I've heard William Lane Craig bring this up. Assuming that God really did command the killing of innocents, why did he ask Israel to do it? I mean, God could have killed and can kill anybody he wants at any moment. He doesn't need Israel to come in and kill certain people and not others. He seemed to have done that with Sennacherib's army. One night, many of them just fell. Thousands of them fell at God's hand. Why would he want the Israelites to go and do this seemingly horrific task?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it appears that as you read through the Pentateuch, the book of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy, and beyond, you see a gradual decline in God's plan to basically single-handedly address the Canaanite issue to now, in light of Israel's disobedience, to place the onus on them, that they were basically creating trouble for themselves by imitating the Canaanites even before they entered the land of Canaan. And so you have, for example, use this back in Exodus, even before the golden calf incident that comes up in Exodus 32. And in Exodus 23, the Lord promises, he says, I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets ahead of you, that they may drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate, and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little, until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. So here you have this mention, and then it goes on to say, you shall make no covenant with them or their gods, and warns of, against their being, lest they become a snare to you. So that's the end of Exodus 23. Fast forward to Judges chapter 2, where the Lord, the angel of the Lord says that God won't break covenant with you. He says, as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed me. Therefore also I will not drive them out before you, but they will become as thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. So here you have this sort of language that sounds a lot different than the way things started out in Exodus 23. So as the Israelites continue to complain, to disobey, to engage in idolatry, not just at Mount Sinai with the golden calf, but even as they engage in idolatry and sexual immorality at Baal Peor in Moab, mentioned in Numbers 25, you see repeatedly the people disobeying, complaining, rebelling against the Lord and against Moses and so forth. And so this is the kind of consequence that comes. Even at the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua tells them to put away the idols that are among you, to get rid of them and so forth. So the Israelites are continuing to engage in these idolatrous practices throughout their wilderness wanderings and beyond. So I think you see this downward decline in God, if you will, being less and less willing to single-handedly drive out the Canaanites and putting more and more of the burden on the Israelites. And eventually they're becoming entrenched with these Canaanites and intermingled with those Canaanites rather than being driven out. I think it's helpful to keep this in mind, too, that there is a twofold strategy that is unfolding, that there's first this language of driving out. And if you're driving out people, you're not killing them. David was driven out from the presence of Saul. Adam and Eve are driven out from the garden. They're still alive after they've been driven out. But those who stick around after the Israelites come to drive them out, they leave themselves vulnerable to being killed. If they don't flee, knowing the God of the Jews, of the Israelites, is one who is powerful, who is able to overthrow the gods of the Egyptians, who is able to bring them out of the Red Sea and so forth. There's a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. If you don't pay attention to this God, if you're going to stick around, this is insanity. This is crazy. So you can repent. You can turn. God is always willing to receive those who turn to him. And so we see that with Rahab. We see that with the Shechemites at the end of Joshua 8, that these people in Shechem between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, they're engaging in a covenant renewal ceremony where Joshua is reading the law, and they are becoming part of the people of Israel. They're embracing the one true God. So this is certainly an open question, an open possibility to the Canaanites, because, you know, God by nature is willing to receive those who are repentant, those who turn from their wicked ways, and to incorporate them into his own people. But those who resist, those who continue to refuse, those who rebel, then judgment awaits them. But God is willing to show grace and compassion to those who desire to turn from their wicked ways and respond to the one true God.
You also point out that, and I don't think many people realize this, that God issued the same commands against idolatrous Israel in several places. In other words, this seemed to be more like sinocide than genocide. In other words, the issue was sin. It wasn't an ethnic group that just by the fact that they were this ethnic group, they needed to go. They needed to go because they were sinning. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, there really wasn't any noticeable difference between the Israelites and the Canaanites. They spoke the same language. They dressed the same. They had a lot of the same cultural customs. You put an Israelite and a Canaanite side by side, you couldn't tell the difference. And really what was fundamentally distinct was the gods that the Canaanites worshipped, the moral code that the Canaanites followed, and so forth. You know, these were, at least in principle, said to be markedly different. So yes, there is no ethnocentrism here, and God says, if you do the same sorts of things, you know, and he mentions this in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, but if you do these things, then the land is going to vomit you out just like it vomited out the Canaanites before you. So God is, in fact, the Israelites end up being punished. They end up, going into exile, the northern kingdom with the Assyrians, and then you have the southern kingdom with Babylon. So God makes good on his word. In fact, in Jeremiah 25, you see that God said he used the same language of cherem, to utterly destroy. God says, "I will utterly destroy you and leave your villages desolate," and so forth. Now, of course, you get to the end of the book of Jeremiah, and you see that, the southern kingdom is disabled politically and economically and religiously and socially and so forth. So, everything is falling apart, but it's not as though, all of them have been utterly destroyed. You have a lot of people still remaining behind in the land. You have the urban elite from Jerusalem going to Babylon, but it's not as though they've been utterly wiped out, even though God says, "I will utterly destroy you." So, very interesting to note, that passage that is directed toward the Judahites, the southern kingdom of Judah, and God using that very same term that is used of the Canaanites.
You spend a lot of time also on trying to point out that the Old Testament and New Testament gods are the same God. I know it's hard to do in 2 minutes, but why would you say they are the same God?
Well, for one thing, Jesus affirms that he has come to represent to embody, he is the one who is, he says, the one who has seen me has seen the Father, this God of the Old Testament. I'm the one who is coming to represent him. Jesus affirms the reality of, say, the judgment on the, of the flood and of Sodom. He is pronouncing judgment on the cities of his own day in say, Matthew 11. Woe to you, Bethsaida and Chorazin, and so forth. He's promising judgment. Jesus is, we see in the New Testament the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul talking about these same Israelites who've been judged and God punishes them, and that many people are killed through God's judgment. He says, these are to be an example for you. Of course, a negative example, not to imitate them. But Paul is not apologizing for the God of the Old Testament and the judgment that he brings upon the people of Israel and so forth. He mentions the Canaanites in Acts 13, that the Israelites drove them out, and so does Stephen in Acts 7. And in fact, the book of Hebrews says that these were the judgments in the Old Testament, how much greater, how much more severe will the judgment be if we neglect so great a salvation through Christ? So we see that in Hebrews 2 and Hebrews 12, the greater severity. So we see both the love of God ratcheted up or intensified, as well as the wrath of God intensified. So we see, Paul says in Romans 11:22, "Behold the kindness and the severity of God." Both are seen in the Old Testament. Both are seen in the New.
It's interesting. The New Testament, if we go from, say, Abraham to Malachi, that's, I guess, covers about 1,500 years of history. And there are these isolated instances of violence in the Old Testament that God seemingly commands, whereas the New Testament covers about 60 years of history. I submit to you that if the New Testament covered 1,500 years of history, you'd see a lot more judgment in the New Testament than you do in the Old. Notwithstanding, the New Testament does introduce these issues of judgment. You already mentioned, Paul, and of course, hell and hellfire and these other aspects of God being a judge, not just this soft soap sentimentality that many people think is love today. We're talking to Dr. Paul Copan. His book is called Did God Really Command Genocide? Coming to Terms with the Justice of God. When we come back, we're going to deal with the two questions. How does the Old Testament commands to kill differ from what ISIS is saying and what the Quran says? And aren't we supposed to turn the other cheek? I'm Frank Turek. Back in two. Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. Did God Really Command Genocide? That's our topic today with Dr. Paul Copan. We're going to get right back to Dr. Copan in just a minute. Just want to let you know of some events coming up. Doing several events in South Dakota mid-February, and then in Oklahoma, including Oklahoma University, February 24th. And Jay Warner Wallace will speak there February 25th. Then we're doing a Fearless Faith event in Oklahoma, the 26th and 27th of February, so check that out. Then Dr. Copan and myself will be in Calgary, Canada in March, like March 4th, 5th, somewhere in there, and that weekend. All the details are on the website, crossexamined.org. Paul, what's your website? If people want to see where you're going to be, where do they go?
Just paulcopan.com, C-O-P-A-N.
Okay, paulcopan.com. Paul Copan, C-O-P-A-N.com. Check him out there. He's got fabulous books that he's written over the past decade or so. Dr. Copan does. So check those out. Today we're talking about Did God Really Command Genocide? And Paul, before the break, we were talking about killing innocents, supposed innocents. Is that something that God can do? But let me ask you this. This is often brought up. How do the Old Testament commands to kill or to drive out the Canaanites differ from what, say, the Quran says and what ISIS believes?
Sure. I mean, there are a number of differences here. And so when we look at the Quran, we see a command to strike terror in them, to inflict harm and so forth. It's not as though there is a time limit to this sort of a thing. This seems to be something that is of an ongoing nature, something that is universal. It's not restricted to a particular wicked people. It's not restricted to a particular location. It's not restricted to a slice of time. This is global. This is for the Muslim. This is something that is a universal command. And Muhammad himself said, in his farewell speech, he said that, Allah has called me to fight until all men say there is no God but Allah. And Muhammad himself, his own life, exemplified this this outward thrust to conquer. He was involved in over 80 battles himself. And in the book, we document a number of the sorts of things that Muhammad did in his warfare tactics and so forth. Whether it be breaking treaties or engaging in certain atrocities, we see this sort of a thing going on. So Muhammad himself is setting the example. The Quran itself is setting the tone of an ongoing sort of thing. And also the hadith, the traditions that surround the life of Muhammad, from which many Muslims get their understanding of the life and example of Muhammad, these really strongly inform many Muslims. So people who are engaged in terrorist activity and so forth, it's not surprising to see this sort of a trajectory, actually, given the sorts of things that you see going on in the hadith, these traditions of Muhammad. So we see a remarkably, something that is remarkably different when it comes to the Israelites. We see that this is localized. It is temporary. It is God patiently waiting for people who are wicked, engaging in what we would consider criminal activities in any civilized society. This does not sound like ISIS at all.
Hmm. And this also goes to something that you bring up, Paul, quite well in the book, and that is the Old Testament saints had very good miraculous support, that it was God speaking to them, which dovetails into a question I wanted to ask you, because the way you answered in the book. The question is this: what would you say to someone who claimed God told him to kill people, like someone today who said that, and then you say this is tied up in miracles? Can you explain what your response would be?
Sure. Yeah. The this is a, what if and I think the example that we give in the book is
the Texas governor
Matt Flanagan actually brought up. What if God told me to, God tells this terrorist to blow up a bus full of children? What if a terrorist says that sort of thing? Well, for one thing, we need to remember that just because someone sincerely believes this doesn't mean that God actually commanded such an act.
Right.
That, of course, Jesus himself said that many people will try to do all sorts of evils in the name of God in John 16. And but an act would be obligatory only if God truly has commanded it, not if one imagines that God has commanded it. So an act would be right and obligatory only if, and you have to ask this question. Is this a command from a rational, fully informed, loving, just being? So we have to say, is basically morality being turned utterly upside down? Is this now the norm to engage in this, or is this the exception? In the absence of objective reasons to the contrary, and we have to include several things here that we talk about in the book, these public signs and wonders that were given to Moses and Joshua that made it very clear that the God of the Israelites was not just giving a private revelation, but was one who is making this publicly accessible to all people, saying, these are my people. I am a God who is not to be tampered with. You have those public signs and wonders. Again, we have to ask this terrorist, so what are the sorts of signs and wonders that you have accompanying this unique command? What about the prophetic credentials that you have? I mean, Moses had prophetic credentials, and God was one who continued to defend those credentials. That he was one who saw God face to face, Deuteronomy 34 says, that God spoke to him very clearly. And also, we read in Matthew 7, what about the, it says, by their fruits you'll know them. But what is the moral character of this prophetic oracle, that is behind this prophetic oracle? What is the character of this terrorist like? Is he someone who lives a life of moral fruitfulness or of moral degradation, of bringing harm to people routinely and so forth? You see, if you don't have those signs and wonders, if you don't have the solid prophetic credentials, if you don't have the virtuous character that's supposed to go along with what it's, what God says are to be those who are true prophets rather than false ones, then we have good reason to think that God didn't actually command the blowing up of that bus.
And the reason I said Texas governor before, our listeners are going, why did Frank say Texas governor? Because you have an example in the book about a Texas governor, but I'll let people get the book to see what that's about. It had to do with the same kind of question, if somebody was thought they got revelation from God to kill somebody. So basically what we're saying here, there was no miraculous confirmation, as even Muslims will admit, that Muhammad got confirmed by miracles. In fact, in the Quran, he says, I don't do miracles. I'm just a plain warner. And unlike the Old Testament and the New Testament, where there's public display of miracles that even the Canaanites knew. The Canaanites knew that the God of the Bible was the true God because they had seen some of these miracles themselves. So the two are not analogous, the Old Testament commands and the commands from the Quran. And just to sum up, then the people who say they're getting revelation from God today to kill people, it's not been confirmed by any miraculous means. Now, let me ask you this, Dr. Copan. We're talking to Dr. Paul Copan. His book is called Did God Really Command Genocide? Coming to Terms with the Justice of God. And it's co-written with Matthew Flanagan. I think this issue of the justice of God we forget in our culture, because Christians are thought to be people who are supposed to always turn the other cheek, whatever that means in this context, and we're supposed to be nonviolent. And Jesus would never raise his voice at anybody. Jesus would never resort to violence. And forget all this justice stuff. Let's just love everybody and forgive everybody. You have a couple of chapters that deal with that. Just unpack them a little bit for us, Paul, would you?
Sure. We need to be careful about taking certain scriptures and making all else revolve around those and indeed force-fitting all other texts into those verses. So when Jesus talks about loving your enemies, praying for those who persecute you, we see Paul picking up on this language in Romans chapter 12, where it says that, you know, if your enemy is hungry, you know, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink, and so forth. You know, and that you shouldn't take vengeance. You should engage in personal retaliation. But then, you know, but to leave room for the wrath of God. And then we see in chapter 13 of Romans that it is the state that is to be the minister of vengeance. That the state, the minister of the state, is to be carrying out the, punishing evildoers and to protecting the innocent, preserving peace. That this is its role, and so there is, that's not in conflict with the personal command not to retaliate, but to the state has its role in protecting the innocent and in defending justice and so forth and carrying out punishment to those who are deserving of it. So you have a proper place for, I would say, the police force, the use of force for these good reasons, and that God has given a duty to the state to engage in this way. And I would say, by extension, that's the domestic front. There's also soldiering, which is also morally permissible, presuming that the cause is just. But we see that even Roman soldiers are not told to abandon their tasks as, you know, preserving the peace. They're told not to receive bribes or to extort money and so forth, but they're not told to leave their life of sin or something like that. That's just not what Jesus or John the Baptist are saying, or even Peter and with Cornelius, who's a centurion but God-fearing. In Matthew chapter 8, you have a centurion who has faith in Jesus. In fact, Jesus says, you know, I haven't seen such faith in all of Israel. So we don't see soldiers getting knocked as doing bad, you know, doing immoral things. In fact, the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts, when his life is under threat by a mob, he informs through his nephew the commanding officer, and the commanding officer seeks to protect Paul using military force if necessary to preserve the life of this Roman citizen, which is exactly what the government should do. So this is, you know, so we see Paul himself who says, you know, don't retaliate, but he's also calling upon a commander to protect his life because, you know, and again, even if need be, lethally to do so. That is what the government is supposed to do, to protect the innocent, to punish the guilty, to punish the perpetrator, and so forth. So there is no conflict here. And so we, rather than force-fitting everything into turning the other cheek is to be, you know, willing to receive another insult.
That's Dr. Paul Copan. Paul, thanks so much for being on the show. We're out of time. You got to get his book, friends. Did God Really Command Genocide? Fabulous book. There's a lot more than we can even discuss here. So thanks so much to Dr. Paul Copan. I'm Frank Turek. See you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.